This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, we're broadcasting live from the Willard Hotel here in Washington, D.C. for FRC's Faith and Family Summit. We got a gathering of our supporters from across the nation here. Great group. It's a live audience, right? You guys are live? Okay, yes, they're live. And it's been a lively day here in Washington, D.C. In fact, I'll talk more about the summit. We had a special guest drop by. I'll tell you who that was a little bit later. Of course, you in the room know who it was, but I'm going to tell our listening audience who it was a little bit later. But it's appropriate that this was a lively day here in Washington, D.C. because it has been a lively week. We've got a power-packed program for you today. Last night, President Trump ordered a missile strike on a Syrian airbase after the Bashar al-Assad regime used chemical weapons. Retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and Michelle Bachmann, a former member of the House Select Permanent Committee on Intelligence, joins us for that discussion, what it means going forward for the United States. And it happened today. The United States Supreme Court has a new member. The U.S. Senate confirmed Judge Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Long awaited. Well, one of the men who helped shepherd that through was Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, and he joins us live here on Washington Watch this afternoon. Also, New York Times bestselling author Joel Rosenberg is out with a new book, Without Warning. He'll join me for a discussion about his new book, as well as his visit earlier this week with the Egyptian president. That's coming up here on Washington Watch. And we'll talk with researcher George Barna about groundbreaking research on the worldview of Americans. How many Americans have a biblical worldview? We'll find out when we talk with George Barna a little later here on Washington Watch. So don't go anywhere because you will miss something. And if you do, if you have to stop the car and get a gas or milk or bread or something on your way home, remember, TonyPerkins.com, all the programs are archived there. So if you miss anything on the way home, you can catch it tonight. Again, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T. Perkins. U.S. warships fired nearly 60 Tomahawk missiles at a Syrian airbase Thursday night. President Trump ordered the airstrike in response to this week's deadly chemical attacks in Syria. Joining us now to talk more about this, General Jerry Boykin, retired from the United States Army, Executive Vice President of the Family Research Council, and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, who was a member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's always a privilege.
General Boykin, great to have you with us as well.
I enjoy being with you most of the time.
Well, we're not going to get into the fact how you didn't make it in the Marine Corps, but we're not going to talk about that. All right. Let me start with you, General, because I know you have to slip away to go do a Fox interview. Last night, how significant was it that this early in the Trump administration that he responded as directly as he did in Syria?
Well, I think it's very significant. First of all, there are rumors that his national security apparatus is in a shambles. In 2 days, they planned and executed what I think was a significant operation there. And that shows cohesion and cooperation among his national security staff. So I think it dispelled that rumor. Secondly, though, I think that it was a strong message, not just to Bashar al-Assad or even to Vladimir Putin. I think it was a strong message to the whole world that he is a man of action. And at the right time, with the right provocation, he will act. Now, it's significant also that he is in negotiations and discussions with China right now. What I hope comes out of this is that he's able to use the credibility that he gained from that strike with the Chinese premier by saying, either you deal with Kim Jong-un and the North Korean situation, or I will. And we'd prefer that you do it. And it carries credibility when he does that.
Michelle, this is obviously a new day when we've seen for the last 8 years a sense of weakness on the international stage, anything but weak in terms of this response. What do you think this does in terms of the, you know, you've studied foreign policy as you were a candidate for president as well. What is the message that we see these despots and dictators now across the country analyzing?
They now know that Donald Trump is not only President of the United States, he's the Commander-in-Chief. He has fully stepped into the boots of being Commander-in-Chief, and he is willing to listen to his advisors and act decisively when the time comes. He also has shown that a red line was crossed. I was there and present when Barack Obama said Syria better not cross the red line. They did cross the red line. He failed to do anything, and Barack Obama emboldened the worst impulses and the worst actors across the globe. This is a very different message that was sent. I think it was a significant message that was sent. Now the question will be, in Syria, what will be the outcome? The question is, will we have a Sunni outcome where the Islamic State or some similar jihadist enclave takes over and runs that country? Or will we have a Shia Iranian presence? Iran right now is acting in concert with Russia. Will we have a failed state in the way that Libya was left after Barack Obama unilaterally began an action in Libya? There are many outcomes that are at stake. This is an opening salvo, one that is good, but from here, the options are fewer, the options are more complicated, it is very difficult, but we also know that Israel was left in a very insecure, volatile position. They were like prey with the chemical weapons that were present. I also, and I'll make this quick, I also was on the Intelligence Committee when Secretary of State Kerry told us unequivocally that there were no chemical weapons left in Syria. That now has been proved a lie. And in time and time again, in the last week, we have seen things that the Obama administration told us have been proved now a lie. Donald Trump has been proved right over and over and over again, whether it's about surveillance from the Obama White House. He has been proved right. I think this is politically a victory for Donald Trump. I do not believe he took this action based on politics. I think he did it based upon the national security interests of the United States.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, retired. General, let me ask you this. Michelle said this, the options from here get more narrow. Assad got a message, but yesterday we heard a message from the Secretary of State saying that Assad had no legitimate ability to lead the country. Is there more to come in this? How extensive was this attack, and what else may be coming?
It was not an extensive attack. I think it was probably more symbolic than it was any kind of devastating military attack. But it was to send a message. I think this is as far as it's going to go, personally. I do not think that we're going to have to strike again, because I think he got the message. Let me add that there is another option, and that is to leave Bashar al-Assad in power. I want you to consider that he's never killed Christians. In fact, he's let them serve in his legislature, and he's never threatened Israel. You know, there's been bluster by his father, but he's never threatened Israel. Now, he's a demon. He is an evil despot. But that part of the world is full of these people. Did he get the message? So what Trump's got to ask himself is, what do I want as an end state? A change of behavior or a change of regime? And it can go either way. But be careful what you ask for. Remember, we helped to overthrow Gaddafi. What did we get?
Right.
The Muslim Brotherhood. We helped to overthrow Saddam Hussein. What did we get? The mullahs from Iran running the show. So it's easy to say, that evil man, there's no place in the world for that evil man. But we got to get in the real world, we got to be realistic, and we got to understand there may actually be a worse option than Bashar al-Assad staying in power.
Michelle, this appears to have been it appears that post this strike last night that there's bipartisan support. We're hearing from both Democrats and Republicans. Of course, you look at the backdrop, chemical weapons used against children, families. It's really difficult, I think, for the Democrats to say anything, but it is unique that there is clear bipartisan support for this effort.
There was. When you consider the president of the Senate, Chuck Schumer from New York, couldn't do enough to bash the President of the United States in the weeks leading up to this, and there was very strong bipartisan support. It's very difficult to watch the events of chemical warfare, sarin gas attacks, and see the effects and know again that this is literally within miles of the Israeli border and think that this is something that can be allowed to go on. It was a very significant move that was made, but I think we also need to remember Assad, the head of Syria, made a lot of really not only stupid but tragic moves in the way that he's dealt with his own people. But we also need to remember that he's a puppet and a poodle. He's a poodle for Iran, and he's a puppet for Russia. And the other thing I think people should realize is that the United States was the dominant player for the last 35 years in the Middle East. Tragically, Barack Obama pulled the United States influence out of the United States under his watch, out of the Middle East, and he allowed Russia in. We kept Russia out of the Middle East for over 35 years. Now who's the big player in Syria? Right. It's Russia. And it's a very strange, almost Ezekiel 38-39 confluence of Russia, Iran, and Turkey that have come together with significant impact. And it takes a lot of wisdom, and that's where I would say to our audience, which is a Bible-believing audience, this is the time for prayer for our leadership, that wisdom would come into the ear of our president so the right godly decision and path forward is made. These are volatile times. The world is on fire. We need a president who's going to make decisions based upon godly wisdom.
Well, as General Boykin pointed out earlier, there does not appear to be any disarray in the president's cabinet.
That's
making
right.
a decision like this with such precision. It was at 4 p.m. yesterday Eastern that the president gave the order for those missiles to be launched.
And
from
it was unanimous agreement within the National Security Council.
The evidence was clear, and the president, I think, paving the way for that, calling these attacks horrible and barbaric, and said the victims, including beautiful babies, adding that no child of God should ever suffer such horror. And so I think he set the backdrop here very clearly, innocent civilians, children being attacked, and so taking very swift and decisive action, launching those Tomahawk missiles off of the USS Porter, nearly 60 of those missiles. Again, shock and awe, not designed to inflict casualties, human casualties, but rather send a strong message to that part of the world.
That's right, and it also shows the fact that the United States does remain the leading superpower of the world. We have tremendous power behind our words that has been available to us. Barack Obama let the finest world's military defense system sit on the shelf, and now Donald Trump, who I do not believe is a warmonger, is saying that there are limits, and when push comes to shove, the United States will take those limits. It will take the measures to deal with inhumane actions against people in the world.
It is a new day in America and in the world. Michelle Bachmann, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tony.
All right, folks, don't go away. Coming up next, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa will be here with a review of today's confirmation of Neil Gorsuch, the newest justice to the United States Supreme Court. That's coming up next here on Washington Watch. Also, Joel Rosenberg still to come, and George Barna. Great lineup. Don't go anywhere. You don't want to miss any of today's Washington Watch. Don't go away.
We at the American Family Association believe men should not be allowed to use women's restrooms or dressing rooms. Yet the policy of Target allows just that. Do you agree that this policy poses danger to our women and children? Then sign the Boycott Target Pledge. When you do, you're saying, until Target makes the safety of women and children a priority, I'll shop elsewhere. The good news is the boycott is making a big difference. A Target financial report indicates a dramatic drop in their sales and earnings. And a Wall Street Journal article clearly shows that Target CEO Brian Cornell regrets his company's policy announcement welcoming men to use women's restrooms and dressing rooms. We're convinced that together we can stop this insanity before more women and children become victims. Sign the pledge today and tell others about the boycott. Go to afa.net/target. That's afa.net/target.
We've always had an interest. God has given us a gift of being able to help a lot of people with their finances and budgets and stuff.
AFA supporters Bernie and Alice Larson met Dan Celia at a Faith, Family, and Finance town hall meeting.
And he answered some questions, and we were thinking about the charitable gift annuities, and we'd never heard of that before, but we thought, well, we'd always wanted to leave some of our money for God, but we didn't know where or how. And we felt like this was put into our laps as answer to our prayers as to what we could do after we're gone.
Bernie and Alice learned a charitable gift annuity from the AFA Foundation would provide them with a monthly income for life, as well as supporting the American Family Association into the future. You can learn more about charitable gift annuities and other financial products at afafoundation.net or call 800-326-4543, extension 345.
And you just can't outgive God.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. With the election and inauguration, there was great hopefulness that the Muslim Brotherhood would finally be officially recognized as what it is, a terrorist organization. Even so, many at the highest levels remain oblivious. Yet Senator Ted Cruz has introduced a much-needed Senate bill called the Muslim Brotherhood Terrorist Designation Act of 2017. However, according to a WND article, quoting, President Trump has decided not to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a foreign terrorist organization, at least for now, unquote. Has our president suddenly chosen to also look the other way? If he has, we are in a world of trouble. Urge President Trump to once and for all designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization and to stand up for the people against this dangerous enemy, the Muslim Brotherhood. Call 202-456-1414, 202-456-1414. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along on this Friday afternoon, broadcasting live at the Willard Hotel, just a couple of blocks from the White House for FRC's annual Faith and Family Summit. We've got a group of our supporters from across the country here. We don't often get to do this in front of a live audience. I sometimes have a not-so-live audience, but you guys are a live audience. So glad to have you along with us here today as we do Washington Watch. We had a little special treat today. Shortly after, our next guest is going to be joining us in just a moment, the senior senator from Iowa who helped shepherd through our newest member of the Supreme Court. But shortly after the vote took place there in the United States Senate and the confirmation took place of Neil Gorsuch, we had a guest stop by here. We had the Vice President of the United States, who is the President of the Senate, Mike Pence, stopped by. And so we had a nice visit with him here at the Willard. It was great to see him. But this is a historic day. Neil Gorsuch will be the 113th Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. The Senate confirmed the 49-year-old Gorsuch after a long and bitter fight. The vote was 54-45, and joining us now is the senior United States Senator from Iowa and chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee who helped shepherd this nominee through the process, Senator Chuck Grassley. Senator, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Well, listen, I'm always glad to be with you, and anytime you want me, give me a call. I'm glad to talk to you about, particularly about this good thing we got going now.
Well, let me first say congratulations, Senator. I know that you took some heat in following what has been precedent, that in a presidential election year that we not allow a seat on the United States Supreme Court to be filled by a president on his way out the door. And you took some heat for that, but you took the stand. And today, I think you saw the fruit of your labor. So let me just say congratulations.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad you recognize the precedent that we had as a result of Biden's statements and Schumer's statements of 8 and 20 years ago, I guess, in which they set this pattern. And if they hadn't set this pattern, I don't think we would have felt confident doing what we're doing. But you couldn't have one rule for Democrat presidents, another rule for Republican presidents. So That's why we kept the seat vacant, let the people have a voice. And even on election night, everybody expected Hillary Clinton to be elected president. And if she had been elected president, we would have had to process her nominee the same way we did now today. So we were following the rules, and maybe the Democrats regret they made those statements in the past, but that's what they said, and so it's kind of a standard procedure now.
Well, let me talk about another procedure, Senator Grassley, because earlier this week, the Republicans also followed the kind of in the footsteps of the Democrats when it came to the judicial filibuster, now paving the way for a simple majority vote of judicial nominees to the United States Supreme Court, which I have to think is going to make it much easier for any other vacancies that come up for the court.
Yeah, and this is another thing that maybe the Democrats will regret, that when they decided, I think it was 2001, their words changed the ground rules on whether or not you can filibuster judges, and they did it during the George W. Bush administration. So naturally, it was continued by Republicans during the Obama administration, and then they even went another step and did what I call the Reid rule, but you can call it nuclear option. For every position that the president sends to the Senate, except for the Supreme Court, they were going to have 51 votes because they wanted to pack the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and they did pack it. So we basically did yesterday what they did in November of 2013, and so all of these positions now are subject to just a majority vote to stop debate and get the passage. But as a matter of fact, it's kind of getting back to square one because between 1789 and 2001, there hadn't been filibusters of judges. Or a person like Clarence Thomas wouldn't be on the Supreme Court because he got there 52-48. Mm-hmm. In that day, any one senator could have kept him off the Supreme Court.
Yeah, well, let's say that, let me just put it this way. I do hope the Democrats regret changing those rules, because I'm hopeful that Donald Trump may, as president, may have the opportunity to put one or two, maybe even three more Supreme Court justices onto the court. And, of course, you're going to be in that role of shepherding them through the process. Anything that you see the Republicans doing different in any future nominees?
No, in fact, I think the Republicans will be almost obligated. Maybe I better say President Trump will be almost obligated to pick somebody off of that list of 20 that's left on the list now the court is off, that he published last year, and he's the only president that ever told people ahead of time the type of person he put on the bench, and I think he's obligated to take somebody off that list. And so if he does, then we will do the same thing we did this time, and hopefully have as much Republican unity as we had this time, and we'll get improved. And the only thing we won't have to do this time that we did last time is the nuclear option.
Well, Senator, we're almost out of time, but I want to mention or ask you one final question, Senator Grassley. As you mentioned that list, that the president, two lists with the 20 names that he put out there, how significant do you think that was in the outcome of this presidential election?
I think exit polls show that it was a big thing for at least 20% of the voters, and probably a big thing, but maybe second to the economy, for a majority of the voters. And it's something that Trump talked about all the time, and I never gave a campaign speech in Iowa without my concentrating on it.
I think it was a huge issue myself, and I want to commend you once again for holding to that precedent. That seat remaining open was a tangible reminder to voters this election had significant consequences. Today, we saw some of the fruit of that labor come to being. So, Senator, thanks so much for being with us, and once again, thanks for a job well done.
Okay, goodbye, Tony.
Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa. To find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, how many Americans have what we would call a biblical worldview? Well, I'm going to have the answer for you. Well, maybe not me. George Barna is going to have the answer when he's with us when we return. Don't go away. We're back with more after this.
Making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
Okay, so we had a disappointing job numbers. It came out at 98,000 jobs created. That is obviously down. We need a lot more than that. But here's the thing. Our unemployment rate went down to 4.5%. That's the lowest level in 10 years. As a matter of fact, I am still, as I was in the last 8 years, but certainly in the last 3 years, struggling to believe that number. Here's the good news. There is some good news in all of this. Although the market's knee-jerk reaction was very negative as soon as these numbers came out. But, you know, I wrote an article, and you may have seen it, that talked about this whole Syria attack and the job numbers and all those things and how all of that is going to look. So very interesting as we think about that. But let me just say that we're still in 1978 from a labor participation rate. But the labor participation rate again got better. It went from 62.8 to 63. That's good news. Unemployment rate, as I said, falls to 4.5%. But the real good news is the U6 number. The U6 number, this is the rate of underemployment, which is probably a more accurate picture of where we are in our unemployment. That went under 9%. Folks, it's been a very long time since that has been down below 9%. And that tells us that we're getting an awful lot of part-time workers and underemployed workers that are finding good, solid jobs. Also a little disappointing was hourly pay increase was at 2.7%. Pretty good, but it's down from 2.8%. But all in all, that's a pretty decent number. I don't think this is all negative. I think there's more positive in this than negative.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad you're with us on this Friday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you miss any of our interviews earlier, be sure and check that out. Everything's archived right there at TonyPerkins.com. All right, your worldview is extremely important. That's basically, it's the lenses through which you see the world and you process things. So, when we talk about having a biblical worldview, that is looking at the world through the lenses of Scripture and making your decisions and your choices based upon that. Well, how many Americans actually have a biblical worldview? Well, joining me now with the answer to that is a good friend, a well-known author and researcher who knows the answer to this, George Barna. George, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Tony. It's great to be here.
George, you just recently conducted some of the most in-depth analysis when it comes to worldview that you've done in your years of research.
Yeah, actually, it was the biggest study and the most in-depth study. We had 40 different questions about people's beliefs and behavior as it relates to worldview, and we interviewed over 4,000 people.
Okay. What were the results?
Yeah, essentially what we found out is among adults in America, people 18 years of age and older, only 10% have a biblical worldview. And you can break that down into different segments of the population. If you were to look, for instance, at born-again Christians, not people who call themselves that, because you can't really trust those labels. We've tested that. But people who say that when they die, they know they'll go to heaven only because they've confessed their sins and accepted Jesus Christ as their Savior. We categorize those people as born-again Christians. Only 30% of them have a biblical worldview.
Wow.
And then you can also look at things generationally to get a sense of, well, where's the country going? So if we look at the two oldest generations, the boomers and the builders, people 50 and older, what we see is that about 16% of those two generations combined have a biblical worldview. Among the next younger generation, Gen X or the baby busters, only 7% have a biblical worldview. And then when you look at the millennials who are in the adult age range, the 18 to 30 year olds, we're down to 4%.
So we're seeing a significant decline in that worldview among, now that the general population?
That's right.
So when we're looking at that going forward, obviously worldview is very significant. It affects politics, it affects education. I mean, it affects everything.
Everything.
How do we fix that?
Well, there are a number of different ways we go about it. One of the most significant things has to do with parenting. And so when we look at the influence on a person's worldview, the three most important things are parents, media, and the law. All of those things communicate to individuals what's right, what's wrong, what's important, what's not, what the boundaries in life are. And so when we talk about parents, one of the reasons why I'm most concerned is when we look at millennials, they mm-hmm. are our current parenting generation. And of course, as a parent, you can't give what you don't have.
Correct.
Only 4% of them have a biblical.
So they don't have it to pass on.
Exactly. So that says that other individuals who do have a biblical worldview, grandparents in particular, would be one group I would look at and say, you know, if they've got it, they've got to step up and recognize that there's a role to fill there.
So it's almost like a worldview intervention. We need grandparents to step in for those that, and maybe they've not passed it on to their children, or their children are just not passing it on to their grandchildren, but there are tools and resources available to help people develop these biblical worldviews.
Yeah, certainly there are. And so it's imperative that people see that as a vital part of their mission, because we wonder, gee, why is church attendance going down? Why are fewer people sharing their faith in Christ with others? All of these things relate to the absence of a biblical worldview.
George Varno, what is the most critical time in which people or young people are developing that biblical worldview, where you would want to get in there and help them understand and walk through and develop that?
Yeah, great worldview. Question, because what we discover is that it's between the ages of 18 months old and 13 years old that a person's worldview is developed. Because you need a worldview to know how to respond to the world, it develops very early. And what we also discover from our research is that the worldview that you have at the age of 13 is, in most cases, and for the most part, the worldview you're going to die with. It may change a little bit as you age, but generally not very much. And so working with children is really the most important thing we can do. It is the primary mission field for the church in America.
Wow, that is significant. And we've got to move away then, I would suggest, from just telling Bible stories to imparting biblical truths if we're going to develop those worldviews.
And one of the most important things we see is dialogue between someone who has a biblical worldview and the person who needs it. And so if they watch a TV show, talk with them about what were the values, what were the principles communicated there. They go see a movie, they listen to a piece of music, they experience something out in the, at the ball game. I mean, all of those things need to be reflected upon, but that's not a natural part of the way that Americans live.
Correct.
We're into achievement and accomplishment and the next experience. Particularly the younger generation has heightened that, because that's the core of a postmodern worldview. It's about experiences. And so they want to move on and have more and more experiences without reflecting on the implications of the ones they've had.
So it's basically digesting what has taken place around us and figuring that how those pieces come into that worldview.
Seeing how it connects to biblical principles, which right. is not a natural tendency in American society.
You have to be intentional about it. George Varno, thanks so much for being with us. Always fascinating to talk to you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Tony.
George Varno, to find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. The fascinating research, and folks, a reminder, especially parents, grandparents, we've got a job to do to raise up that next generation to operate with a biblical worldview, and it's never too late. Easier when they're young, harder when they're old, but never, ever give up. All right, don't go away. We've got more, yes, more Washington Watch to come with Joel Rosenberg, best-selling author of the New York Times, is here to talk about his latest book. Don't go away.
This is Barry McGuire. I'm a car guy, and I love to lead people to Jesus Christ as a layman outside the walls of the church. Our churches are full of overachieving Christians lacking joy in their lives. I know, because I was there, giving generously of my time and resources and loving on my pastor without having that bounce in my step. I knew something was missing, but had no idea what it was until I met Herb Ellingwood. In the space of an hour with a man I didn't know and never saw again, my life was radically and forever changed. God brought Herb into my life to ignite my life with his razor focus on this one thought. God's called all of us to seek and save the lost, that none should be lost. That's why God sent his son to this earth. And when God's purpose for dying becomes your purpose for living, your joy will be full. Your job is to ignite revival outside the walls of the church by moving every person you're with today and every day closer to Jesus. And if you want to know how to do that, go to ROTW.com.
Consider serving with Friendships. It's an all-volunteer ministry providing aid to disaster victims, refugees, and the impoverished here at home and around the world. We're now taking applications. If you're available to serve without pay, you can be part of the crew reaching out to help people in need. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Join Norman Geisler, Richard Land, Michael Brown, Frank Turek, and others for Southern Evangelical Seminary's National Conference on Christian Apologetics. It's October 13th and 14th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Enjoy informative talks, a live debate, and a dialogue with Ken Ham from Answers in Genesis. Plus, there's the premiere of the American Family Association documentary, The God Who Speaks. Register by May 1st and receive a special gift. Visit ses.edu for details.
You know, if you see a huge group of people and they're all in line waiting to do something and they're all happy about it, don't you wonder, okay, what's going on? What am I missing here? Why are these people so excited? In this case, it's thousands of people doing the same thing. They're joining MediShare. MediShare members share each other's medical expenses. It's that simple. They've shared over $1 billion in healthcare expenses since 1993, so they can handle your healthcare expenses too. With MediShare, you get affordable options to fit almost any budget. For most members, MediShare is about half the cost of other healthcare programs. You should at least check into it. This may be one of those things you start doing and then wonder, why didn't I look into this a long time ago? What was I thinking? Don't miss out. You can find out more. Call 855-PSALM-23, now available in Montana. Call 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at TPerkins. Let me remind you folks that this program that you're hearing comes to you because of folks like you across the country. We receive no government money while we're in Washington, D.C. We pay our own freight, okay? This is not national public broadcasting. We exist because of folks like you who are concerned about our nation, our future, about faith, family, and freedom. So if you'd like to know more about how you can be a partner with the Family Research Council and Washington Watch to bring news you can't get anywhere else with the newsmakers, well, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. Well, one of the privileges I have in doing radio and, of course, being here as the president of the Family Research Council, I get to interact with a lot of neat people. I had my list when I first came here 14 years ago to go and see different ones and get to know people. And my next guest is one of those people who's just become a great friend. I've not only spent time with him here in the United States, but I've spent time with him in his new homeland of Israel. He is a dual U.S. Israeli citizen. He is a New York Times best-selling author. I'm three quarters of the way through of his new novel, which is Without Warning, a J.B. Collins novel. My good friend Joel Rosenberg. Joel, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. It's a great honor to be here, and I really appreciate your friendship.
Well,
I value
and,
it.
And I'm sure you appreciate being here at 5:45 in the afternoon as opposed to 45 minutes after midnight in in Israel.
True. When we do your show, it's a little more challenging.
Joel
on that side,
will often...
For you, I will do it, not for everybody.
Yes, and it's a good thing it's radio because I don't know, you know, what he's dressed like at 12:45 in the morning. But he will often stay up late or set his alarm to join the program when something's happening in Israel. So, Joel, thanks so much for being here. Let's talk first about, I want to get to your meeting with the Egyptian president that took place here in Washington earlier in the week, but I want to talk about the new book that's out. How's it going so far? I know you've been on a book tour. How's it going?
Yeah, well, it's sobering to end a five-week book tour for this new book, Without Warning, which is about the threat of Syrian chemical weapons not being removed from Syria by the Russian deal and what could happen, God forbid, and how an American president would respond to that. Now, that's surreal. Like, in almost every person's book that I sign, if I personalize it, I say, pray this book never comes true.
Well, reading the book, and your books are very much like that. They're almost prophetic. And I don't want to give away too much of the book, but I have to tell you, Joel, that I really am thinking hard about attending that next joint session of Congress.
Well, yeah, well, we pray it doesn't come true. In fact, I was so glad that the Vice President came over and spent time with you guys today. I saw him a few weeks ago, and I brought him his and her copies of the novel, because I've known him for a number of years. He and Karen have had my wife and I out to the governor's mansion when they were in Indiana. But he told me he was so grateful to get two copies because he said, this will be good for my marriage, because Karen usually steals my copy when it comes. I mean, not steals. I don't know if you use that term exactly, but that was my impression. And now they can go through it together, but or separately maybe in this case. The book is doing well. It's number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. I think it's resonating with people. Look, Tony, one of the reasons you and I have talked about this is, how do we drive our values, our views, our understanding of and a biblical worldview, for example, into the popular culture?
Right.
And it can't all be done from Washington. I mean, there are ways you have to go out and entertain people. We are in an entertainment age. People don't want to read an op-ed. They don't want to read a 900-page book on the history of the Middle East and its future. I wish they did. They don't. So the question is, how do I keep them up all night? Where at 5 in the morning they are cursing me on Twitter. Well, maybe not cursing, but sometimes because they thought, one more chapter. And I write short chapters, and I make cliffhanger endings so that you think, well, just one more. They're sort of like Pringles. You just can't eat just one. But then how do you weave in?
Well, and they're short chapters.
A worldview, exactly.
And it is tempting to go to the next one and the next one. But now what I do is I cheat a little bit. I get the audio book, I put it on my iPhone, and I run with it. So either I'm going to run for 4 hours, or I'm going to limit myself to the number of chapters.
See, a man of great wisdom. So weaving in information people should know about a what-if scenario, a good political thriller writer should have a scenario that, what if this happened? You're not saying you want it to happen. You're not predicting it will happen. You're saying, God forbid, it would happen. But if it did, how might it play out? And how might our leaders respond to a new what-if, worst-case scenario?
Well, let's talk about that, because in your book, you talk about the chemical weapons. We saw the use of chemical weapons in Syria earlier this week, and we saw a very decisive response by the new Trump administration.
Yes.
Last night when he gave the order, actually at 4 p.m. Eastern time yesterday.
The world's only superpower is back, if he follows up and builds a strategy on it. But it was... throughout Twitter today, there are Obama administration officials, some on the record, most off, saying finally somebody took action against genocidal terrorism. I mean, their president didn't. President Trump has.
And the world has become a much more dangerous place in the last 8 years because of that.
Absolutely. And when you spend time with Israeli leaders, when you spend time with Arab leaders, they will tell you that the moment that the red line was crossed in the use of chemical weapons against civilians in Syria in 2013, and President Obama refused to take action, and in fact was duped by Vladimir Putin, who said, we'll remove all those weapons, which clearly did not happen. But at that moment, a shockwave, a true shockwave went through all of our allies who just couldn't believe that you make a promise, you warn an enemy, don't go there, and then you bail. How in your world can an Israeli a citizen, much less a leader, then handle the Iran nuclear deal? Oh, I see, you're going to be there when we need you? You weren't there. And this is a genocidal enemy on our border. We're not talking about weapons of mass destruction in 10 years. We're talking about it right now. Obama wouldn't do anything, and it's just horrifying. And there's a lot of encouragement in the region right now because there's a new sheriff in town.
Joel Rosenberg, when you look at that, I mean, obviously, even from a Western mindset, you know, to say something and then back away from it, but that's even more pronounced when you look at weakness in the Middle East. I mean, that is pounced on when there's weakness.
That's right. One of the themes of my novels is this line, evil unchecked is a prelude for genocide. And what you have in Assad is someone who has helped set into motion the death of 500,000 people. And more than 7 million Syrians are on the run for their lives. Several million have actually left the country. Others are just moving around away from the war zones. The country only has 28 million people. So one in four citizens of Syria are on the run for their lives. The others are hunkered down, and 500,000 have died. And that's, and then you have ISIS. Like, if that weren't bad enough, then you have ISIS, which is systematically committing genocide against Christians, against Shia Muslims, against Yazidis. And then you have Russia and Iran moving in to say, we're going to help Assad, the slaughterer of Syria. This is such wickedness. This is such wickedness. And to not stand up, it's in America's national interest to not allow evil people to think they can use weapons of mass destruction without a cost.
Right. It is frightening. But as you said, it's a new day under the Trump administration, sending a very clear message.
Well, it's the beginning. I mean, the test here is what then become his goals? Right. What are his objectives? I agree. This was a measured but important first response, and I think it means he is listening to the team that he has around him. He built a very impressive national security team, and for somebody who told us that, you know, he got all his national security information from Sunday morning shows, you know, a new president, no experience, there was a lot of concern. But when you build a team like this, and then you listen to them, and then you execute. This was, to put it in domestic terms, this was a Gorsuch rollout and not a healthcare rollout. Like, that's what you want in national security, right?
True. It is true. And I think listening to his team, he did that. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Joel Rosenberg, my guest. Let's talk about some of these other leaders in the region of the world, how they are responding to, obviously, not just this event, but unfolding events in the Middle East. You had the opportunity this week to meet with the Egyptian president.
How surreal is it for a Jewish person, much less a Jewish evangelical, and an Israeli citizen, to celebrate the eve of Passover with the leader of Egypt? Like, that, like, that's not part of the story. Like, that's not how it's supposed to work. So that was an extraordinary opportunity to be invited to come in and meet with a number of Middle East experts and to meet with the president of Egypt. And I have to say, I wrote a piece for the Jerusalem Post a month ago, encouraging the administration to invite LCC and saying, look, here's a man who's doing a number of important things right. Yeah, there's some things not good. There's some serious human rights issues. Christians need more support and assistance there. But if somebody's doing something right, and the baseline was a radical jihadist named Mohamed Morsi, then you need to encourage him. You need to help him. You need to thank him for the things he's doing right. And to sit with him and this group of people and let him share his worldview and then take 90 minutes of questions from us and then not bolt out to the next meeting. You know, he's leader of 93 million people and a major leader in the Middle East. He spent 20 minutes just chatting with us personally. It was really an extraordinary time. And I came away encouraged that he wants a real strong U.S.-Egypt alliance. He is willing to fight against radical Islam. And he's not just saying that. He's been doing this for 2.5 years as president. And President Obama never once invited him to come and meet with him at the White House. There are only so many adjectives you can figure out how to say what was going on back there. We all know that.
I mean, it comes to a point where you wonder if it was intentional.
Well, in this case, it was, because President Obama supported the Muslim Brotherhood taking power in Egypt. He publicly said that. And in fact, rebuked el-Sisi, who was then the commander-in-chief of the Egyptian military, for removing the Morsi government, which was creating a tyranny, imposing Sharia law. There was churches were on fire, the police stations were on fire, people were dying in the streets, and 23 million Egyptians said, stop, they signed a petition to remove him, and he wasn't going anywhere. And the military moved and said, we've got to save our country. Now, you can criticize some of the ways things were done, and I have criticisms, but to rescue Egypt from radical Islamist leaders was an act of courage, and President Obama specifically thought, that's bad. We don't want you. He suspended aid to Egypt and then never invited him to the White House because he was deeply offended and mortified at el-Sisi removing the radical Islamists from power. I thank God. You know, I was a never Trumper till Thursday before the election. Okay, I concluded that I needed to make that decision. It was a binary choice by that point, so I did it. Pence was a big part of that, but I thought, honestly, am I going to vote against a ticket that has somebody who actually likes my books? I mean, come on, you know. So I say that to put my cards on the table that I have been a critic of Mr. Trump. But as an evangelical, look, it's like a marriage I wasn't sure should happen, but it's happened, and we need to help it succeed. And he's doing a pretty good job, especially in foreign policy. He's embraced Israel again. He's spending time with President el-Sisi and the Jordanian leadership saying, how do we work together against radical Islam? And it's been an incredibly effective week, just this week, much less 76 days or whatever it's been.
77. But who's counting? Joel Rosenberg, we're almost out of time. How can folks get a copy of the book?
Well, Without Warning is in all major bookstores. It's pretty cheap on Amazon right now. You can go to my website, joelrosenberg.com, and there's links to all kinds of online places. And support Christian bookstores. You know, a lot of Christian bookstores are struggling. You buy it from one of them. Buy two.
Yeah, and give one to your wife so she doesn't steal yours.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. It's a pro-marriage policy. I'm with Pence all the way.
Let me, before we wrap up here, how are things in Israel post-election?
Post
the United States election.
Right, yeah, exactly. We may have new elections there. That's right. A different story. Pretty encouraged, actually. We've got a president who likes us, who wants to help us, and I think Israelis are cautiously optimistic. We've got a very dangerous neighborhood, but we've got the healthiest U.S.-Israel relationship I think dating back to the Reagan administration, even when there were some troubles and struggles then. So, you know, for those of us who are, you know, Jewish people, we have a lot of pessimism. We struggle with, you know, we're glass half empty people, like, and we come by it honestly. You know, we've had a tough go of it, you know, but we're cautiously optimistic. Well, and great, and as a believer, grateful to the Lord for his kindness and protecting us.
It's a window of opportunity, which I hope we seize. And of course, folks, all of you out there across this country, you're a part of that, praying, participating, and making a difference right where you are. Joel Rosenberg, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tony. Great to be with you. Thank you.
Folks, we're out of time. I want to thank you for being with us, but I leave you once again with the words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where it says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.